From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, who controls the internet? We talk with Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu, authors of a new book about government regulation and censorship of the net. We'll hear about cases involving Yahoo and Google. Also, Jeff Goldblum, the star of such blockbusters as Jurassic Park and Independence Day, returns to his hometown, Pittsburgh, to star in a production of The Music Man. That's the premise of his new film, Pittsburgh, which is part documentary, part mockumentary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the internet started to really catch on in the 90s, it was widely seen as a form of communication that transcended geographical boundaries, a force for freedom that could not be controlled by governments. But as countries like China have demonstrated, governments are figuring out how to censor information on the net. According to the new book, Who Controls the Internet, the net is splitting apart and becoming bordered. Governments are imposing national laws on the net within their borders. Who Controls the Internet explores the consequences and virtues of an internet regulated by national laws. My guests are the authors Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu. Goldsmith is a law professor at Harvard and headed the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel in 2003 and 2004. Wu is a law professor at Columbia, writes for the online magazine Slate, and previously worked in the internet telecommunications industry. Well, let's look at a case that you consider to be a turning point in government control of the internet. And this was a few years ago when Yahoo was selling Nazi materials on an auction site. And that's illegal in France. France wanted those pages blocked there. What was the case that the French government made?
The auction page was actually on a computer in California, but the French government argued that its availability in France violated French law just the same way as if the goods were actually there or if they appeared in a magazine that was actually there. It argued that when Yahoo was doing business in France, it had to comply with French law just like anyone doing business in France would have to.
And what was the law that the French government said Yahoo was breaking?
They have a law, against the offering of sale of Nazi goods, no matter what the medium.
And this is related to laws against hate speech and hate crimes? And
sure. It grows out of France's experience in World War II with the Holocaust and with the German occupation and the like. And Europe is much more sensitive to hate speech and to Nazi speech than we are in the United States. They have a different conception of free speech, and they regulate these activities much more heavily than the United States does.
Okay, so you described France's case. What was Yahoo's case?
Well, Yahoo argued that it was inappropriate or unfair for France to tell Yahoo what to do in the United States, because remember, the web page was actually located on a computer in the United States. And Yahoo argued that it couldn't stop the goods, the web page, from going into France, and that if it was forced to shut down its website in California, that in effect France would be regulating these Nazi goods for the whole world because Yahoo would have to shut them down to everyone.
And didn't Yahoo also argue that it would be virtually impossible to honor the laws of many different countries while running its websites?
Yes, they argued, first of all, that they couldn't keep the web page out of France and they couldn't comply with 190 different national laws all around the world because they argued the internet is not bordered. We can't keep information from going into different countries. And therefore, the only choice Yahoo had was to allow the web page to be seen everywhere or to shut it down and allow it to be seen nowhere.
So what was the outcome?
The French judge didn't accept that argument. He hired some internet experts who argued, and remember, this was 5 or 6 years ago, he argued that the experts argued that Yahoo could, in fact, screen out information to a reasonable degree. In fact, Yahoo was filtering geographically in its advertising side. So whenever you typed in yahoo.com in France, you would actually receive a French advertisement rather than an English advertisement. The judge argued that Yahoo could filter out to some degree, and he ordered it to take all reasonable steps to keep the web pages out of France. Yahoo eventually complied.
So what precedent did this set internationally?
Well, you know, I think what was so interesting about the case is that it pitted these ideals of the internet, of freedom, of being borderless, of being uncontrollable, and being a medium that anyone could do anything with, against a very set of hard facts that Europe has had a terrible history with anti-Semitism, that people were selling, you know, Nazi-glorifying goods in Europe through the internet. And so suddenly the case for absolute internet freedom didn't seem quite as strong anymore. Faced with a country that legitimately had historical reasons to want to fight anti-Semitism, and I think this case had a strong normative effect on what people thought needed to be some of the limits of freedom. The second thing that this case showed is that when it push came to shove, entities like Yahoo, which had declared themselves unregulable, when threatened with massive fines and potential detainment, suddenly found they had reasons to follow the law. That is to say, Yahoo stood up and said, we're not going to listen to some judgment in some other country just because they say so. But then when threatened with potential detainment, 10,000 euros of fines a day, they suddenly backed down. And this was a shock to people. People had thought the internet was truly unregulable. They never dreamed that a court in France and a single French judge could bring an internet giant like Yahoo with a stock valued at nearly $500 to its knees. But that's exactly what happened. And Yahoo coincided partially with the collapse of the bubble. You know, there was this era that everything was going to be different, money, finance, government, and so on. And this is partially when the real world started to catch up. And that was a turning point in the history of the internet.
So you've been describing how, you know, the French government got Yahoo to take Nazi materials off its internet auction site. Then we have a case of China asserting its wish to censor, and to censor words like democracy and freedom. So this isn't about hate speech. This is just clear out censorship. And Yahoo was involved in this too. Tell us what the story is.
Well, sure. I mean, Yahoo, the funny thing about Yahoo, Yahoo's a pivotal figure in these early days of the law and the internet, because Yahoo, on the one hand, is standing up to France, claiming principles of freedom of speech. On the other hand, it's in China slowly and quietly turning itself into an agent of Chinese state control. They quietly but willingly accept all the duties of self-censorship which the rest of the Chinese media subscribes to. And then bit by bit, they begin to give the Chinese government information it needs, ultimately leading to the arrest of several Chinese dissidents. So there's a little bit of an Apocalypse Now feeling. The once champion of free speech turns into a company, once valued stock at almost $475, dives to $9, becomes, you know, subservient to the Chinese state. And you have, just in that one story of Yahoo, a persuasive picture of what happened to internet freedom over the last decade.
Now, I should say that Yahoo says it gave up a majority stake in its China service to a Chinese company, and that this Chinese company has to follow Chinese law.
That's true. And what's fascinating about that is that Yahoo went to China with these plans to make money and become great. And it ultimately retreated from the Chinese market, having participated. When it handed over the information on dissidents, it did so as Yahoo, not as just an owner in a Chinese company. It eventually ended up retreating from the Chinese marketplace altogether, not because of its controls, but because it lacked the ability to make money in China, because it didn't understand the Chinese market well. So again, the differences in culture and geography ended up mattering a lot more than Yahoo thought. Yahoo thought it could just go to China, do the same thing it did in America, maybe listen to some censorship laws and come up making money, but that didn't end up working.
Now, you describe China as having surrounded itself with the world's most sophisticated information barrier. How do they do it? How do they manage to censor websites from around the world?
Well, technically, it's rather easy, and I actually don't think that's the most important part of Chinese control. But I'll tell you how they do set up that barrier. They simply have a list of sites, which changes frequently, but they have a list of sites monitored through the IP address, which are blocked from inside of China. That is, when those sites are requested from overseas, the routers or the computers at the border simply drop those sites and don't pass them on. It's very easy to do. It's actually easier to drop a site than it is to pass it. And every computer, every router, every part of the internet is designed to be able to drop sites. They're used in corporate security measures and so on. So it's a routine part of the internet to be able to censor, in fact. It's built in to the technology of the internet to be able to censor. And the difference between China and a country like the United States or Canada is that China certainly just turns on the filters.
And has China been able to do this with the help of high-tech expertise from American companies?
Well, sure. You know, I spent time in the early 2000s in China marketing some of these goods, and they use standard American equipment. Most of the filtering technology was originally built for corporate intranets, that is, networks inside companies. designed to control employees, China simply turns that around and uses it to control its citizens.
So did you say you were selling these screening technologies to China?
We were marketing them, that's right, yeah, and selling them.
So how did you feel about that? Did you feel like you were helping China censor its citizens?
Well, we weren't really successful enough. I didn't work for Cisco. I worked for a competing company. And Cisco was the top dog at the day, and they were much more successful. Yeah, I had uneasy feelings about it. We had a lot of meetings with the Chinese ministers, and the whole business seemed to me a bit, you know, the level of submissiveness we displayed to the Chinese government I thought was a little bit unseemly, but that was the way people did business.
Now, you describe China as a paradox because on the one hand, it wants to have the most sophisticated internet system in the world and really excel in high tech, but at the same time, it wants to control the information and censor it.
Yes, that's right. It's completely a paradox. If you go to China today, you will find that their information is flourishing as never before. People are chatting, there's bloggers, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But there's a line in there somewhere, and if you cross that line, you get in trouble very, very quickly. Recently, in the last several months, several Chinese quasi-dissidents, really just journalists, have been abducted, kidnapped for doing pretty mundane things. And in our book, we document cases where just posting a kind of a joke about why prostitutes are better than the government can land you with administrative punishments, imprisonments. So it feels very open. It feels completely normal. And that's what's very strange about the control in China. But you cross a certain line, and it's curtains for you.
You say that the Chinese internet is becoming less and less like its counterparts. Is it only through censorship that it's becoming different, or are there other differences between the Chinese internet and what we're familiar with here?
Yeah, there's a lot of cultural differences that end up being built into it. You know, so you can sort of speculate on why that is. But Chinese people, for some reason, love chat rooms. I don't really know why that is, but they're a dominant form of discourse on the Chinese internet. People chatting away. So certain, you know, chat rooms are not that popular in the United States. They've never really taken off. I'll add another country. If you look at Japan, there is a different structure of the way people use the internet. It's mostly based on cell phone usage, people typing away in the Shinkansen, in the bullet train, or on the way to work. And so there are starting to be stronger differences in the way these networks work, and they're actually being built differently to reflect the different cultural interests of different countries.
My guests are Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu, authors of the new book, Who Controls the Internet? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu. They're the authors of the new book, Who Controls the Internet? They're both law professors, Goldsmith at Harvard and Wu at Columbia. In your analysis of the directions that the internet has taken in different countries and the attempts of government to control that direction, what cultural differences have you come across in how different countries are shaping the internet?
Okay, so we've been talking thus far about how governments are imposing their controls from above, and that's a large factor in why the internet is becoming bordered. But in fact, the internet started to become bordered not because of government controls from above. Governments were in fact fairly slow to react to the internet. The first impetus for a bordered internet, an internet that differed from place to place, actually came from people below who were using the internet in different places, people who spoke different languages, had different values, and the like. So, for example, in the early years of the internet, or at least in the mid-1990s, the internet was dominated by the English language because most websites and most internet users were English speakers. And many people in the 90s thought that the internet would basically be the vehicle for English to sweep over the world. And in fact, the opposite has happened. People in the world who don't speak English don't want to see an internet in English. They want it in their local languages. And so, when you go to different places, you look on internet websites in those different places, and they tend to come up in local languages, reflecting local cultures. The same thing happened with internet advertising. It wasn't very useful to have an advertisement for 1-800-Flowers in New York if you're looking at the internet in France or in China or in India. And so internet users in different places with different tastes and different concerns started demanding an internet that conformed to their local interests. And that, in effect, is how the internet first started becoming bordered. And in fact, it was the technologies developed to enable private demands for local content. It was filtering technologies on the internet, geographical filtering technologies, first grew up in that context to meet private demand. And it was only later that governments came along and used those filtering tools to suit their own ends.
How effective is internet censorship within countries? Do they really censor out all the websites with information that the government considers inappropriate or dangerous for its citizens? Or does a lot of stuff really get through? Is there a lot of freedom and anarchy on the internet in spite of the strictest government's best efforts to clamp down?
Well, sure. It really depends on, in the first instance, how much the government cares about clamping down on information. China is one of the most extreme cases. They're very severe in clamping down on information. But even there, some things get through occasionally and for a short period of time. In the United States, where we value privacy and freedom of speech more, many, many more things get through, even though we try to filter in some respects here as well. But the important point is, for censorship to work, it doesn't have to be perfect. A government doesn't need to cut out the prohibited information 100% to be effective. That's not the way that law works generally. It doesn't try to reduce the incidence of legal violation to zero. It simply tries to keep it at such a rate where the government can achieve the ends it wants. And the Chinese government, for example, they just want to make sure that the government stays in power. That doesn't mean that they can't ever let anything through at any cost. It just means that they can't let information in that's going to lead to a situation where their power will be challenged.
Yeah, I think it's a very mixed situation. I think there's a lot more information out there, but that hasn't necessarily threatened government's control or government's control over themselves. Particularly if you look at countries like Singapore and China, and in particular if you spend time there, there's this weird sensation, as I said, of everything feeling normal. But for some reason, there's something missing, and it's called criticism of government. And you can look for it, but you have to look kind of hard. And if you're just leaving a normal kind of life, you just won't run into it. And in fact, you'll run into much more of what is really propaganda, is people talking about how great the state is, how great the government is. And with there being more total information, there's also a lot more information or a lot more boosting of the state. So the total, there is a greater volume information, but also the mix the government wants of criticism versus state boosterism. And I think it's that ratio between how much support for the state versus criticism, which is really essential, as opposed to just some forbidden content getting through.
Let's look at attempts by the U.S. government to assert its authority over the internet. For example, the government requested that Google hand over its search database so that the government can see who was going to certain porn sites, so it could enforce the Child Online Protection Act. Would you talk a little bit about this case and how it was resolved?
Yeah, so search engines are an important target for government control because almost everything goes through a search engine. And for the most part, the United States hasn't exercised that much control over this. But the Google case showed the potential for it. Google, that case itself was a request that Google turn over a huge amount of search records that it keeps, records on what everybody has searched for as long as Google has been around. They asked for about, I believe, 1 million such records, and they wanted to find out how often people were actually looking for pornography as opposed to other things. But the point of the case, it wasn't that relevant, the actual subject of the case. What was relevant was that it suddenly became obvious to people that government has the power to get from companies like Google, companies like Yahoo, everything that you've ever looked for in your life. And I don't know, for most Americans, I think there's a lot of potentially embarrassing things that they've looked for at one point in their life or another, whether an illness or some strange obsession. And so this case suddenly made it a lot more obvious to Americans that government has the power over the Internet that other countries have been more obviously exercising.
Google fought the government's request. Then the judge reduced the request to apply to only 50,000 web addresses.
Right. And so I think what you I think what you learn from this case, there's a couple things. First of all, the interesting thing is that Google is storing all this information in the first place, which I think is a surprise to many people, that everything you've ever searched for on Google is in a database in a computer somewhere. But the other point more relevant to our book is that, you know, this shows to people that, well, it wasn't a million or 50,000, but it's really the law that's making this decision. Maybe that's not a surprise to lawyers, but I think it's a surprise to people who sort of thought that their search results went off into a little box somewhere, never to come back. They're there if government really wants to look at them. People also speculate that other parts of the government, which do not announce their activities openly, have been also looking at search results, or other parts, you know, parts of the government like the NSA, which aren't required to tell the public or anyone what they're doing, have also been looking at things that people search for.
Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu are the authors of Who Controls the Internet. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Hand in Glove, a novel of psychological suspense by Robert Goddard, author of Play to the End. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, trouble in River City and in Pittsburgh. We talk with Jeff Goldblum about his new film, Pittsburgh, which has him returning to his hometown to star in a local production of The Music Man. Also, we continue our conversation about Who Controls the Internet with Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu, authors of the new book, Who Controls the Internet? It's about how the Internet has gone from a form of communication that seemed to transcend boundaries and exemplify freedom to a system that governments have come to regulate and censor. Goldsmith is a professor of law at Harvard. Wu is a professor of law at Columbia and writes for the online magazine Slate. Since your book is in part a study of how governments have tried successfully and unsuccessfully to assert their authority over the Internet, what are some of the ways you think the government needs to be involved or should be involved with the Internet?
I'm a big believer in Internet freedom, and I'm a big believer of self-governing communities on the Internet. But what our history shows over the last decade is how often these flourishing self-governing communities rely on sort of a baseline of government force for really extreme situations. The eBay story is really the best example. eBay set itself up to be a self-governing community that would rely on feedback and rely on the goodwill of its members. And for the most part, that worked. But they found in the late 90s that they had one day to call the FBI and ask the FBI for help because the fraud problems were becoming just too serious. And so, you know, even eBay, which employs more people today than Walmart, in other words, more people make more money off, see themselves as self-employed. A wonderful thing like eBay has a certain requirement of policing from the government for the really bad types, for the people who won't listen to anything, who don't care about their reputation on eBay. And that's where I think that even the best internet freedoms at some level have some reliance on physical coercion provided by government.
But that's a more kind of ad hoc relationship, isn't it? It's not like the government is a partner in eBay or tells eBay how to run its site. It's just that if there is a scam or fraud on eBay, eBay can turn to law enforcement authorities to help it, right?
To the contrary, they work very closely together. eBay hires former law enforcement officials. It has over 800 right now. And they work hand in hand with federal and state officials. So, you know, they don't just call them in for big cases. They work day-to-day, hand-in-hand, constantly fighting fraud. It is actually quite a, many people are not aware of this, but it is quite a private-public partnership that powers eBay.
This is not a trivial thing, a service that the government's providing. If you didn't have the government willing to help eBay police fraud and prevent it, if you didn't have the government spending its resources to throw people in jail who tried to commit fraud on eBay or throw people in jail who, or at least to enforce contracts for people that make contracts on eBay. If the government wasn't providing these services, eBay literally couldn't exist. It would be a much, much more expensive service. People wouldn't be able to use it nearly as much. And eBay, as we know it, really couldn't happen. So without the hidden hand of government there helping out, eBay and many, many other internet commercial services simply couldn't work.
Have either of you found that your thinking has changed about the relationship of government and the internet?
I think that over the course of writing this book, we both came to discover and appreciate the virtues of government regulation and government control. I think it's fair to say that Tim and I are both, I can't speak for Tim, but I think we're both fairly libertarian. We're suspicious of government regulation, but at least as a starting point. But time and time again in writing this book, we kept stumbling upon the hidden ways that government actually helped out and that government was actually necessary to help make all of our everyday experiences on the internet work.
You know, I was on the internet in the late 80s. I started early on this, and my early career in networking was as a pirate downloading illegal software. I hope the statute of limitations is over now. But, my early days,
I was a pirate. I'll be reporting you as soon as this interview is over.
I was a pirate BBSer, so I sort of have had a long-standing, I'm one of these types who had long-standing contempt for government. I think, too, in writing the book, I became sort of reconvinced of what Hobbes said in The Leviathan, that some of the underlying virtues of basic physical security are very difficult to replace. You know, technology can help, and it's a useful tool, but really there's no substitute for trying to convince and get the right policies. And I've become fascinated, and I think one of the underlying themes of the book is I feel we don't fully understand the effects of lawbreaking and its effect on the law. The internet has inspired a lot of lawbreaking. I mean, our claim in the book is not that somehow government's control has been perfect or nothing has changed or, you know, there's nothing, the internet revolution was nothing. There are a lot of laws that have been broken pervasively. Copyright law is a great example. The law often still remains central to the dispute, but the law gets broken a lot. And I've become very interested in these patterns of lawbreaking, crackdown, lawbreaking, crackdown, and how that changes society, how that changes the law itself, and how that ultimately affects the underlying technology. you know, we're not done with that project and understanding that, but that's something that I think sometimes can actually be good. I think it can sometimes be healthy to have a little bit of law breaking when the technology changes. And so we aren't, or at least I'm not someone who has become, from writing this book, an absolute statist who believes that, you know, the state must control everything like some kind of French political theorist. Rather, I've become interested in the fascinating ways in which law breaking helps us evolve and actually improves the legal system.
Tim, you confessed that earlier in your life you were an internet pirate. So do you think that piracy led to important changes?
Yes, I think it has. You know, by definition, some of the piracy which goes on the internet is criminal, but it's been part of a process whereby we're finally getting to better distribution of music. You know, copyright law throughout its history goes through these waves of piracy. And it was the same with the radio. It was the same with the record player, the original pirate industry. It was the same with cable television. All these industries begin as pirates. And law breaking is almost a necessary part of the industry's evolution to better distribution systems. It's also almost like mutations in the DNA or something. Things have to go wrong before they get better. And so, yes, in some ways, Kazaa, Napster, you know, you can call them pirates, but it's also part of a healthy industrial evolution towards better distribution. And today it may not be perfect, but I notice I can get music on iTunes for 99 cents, and that's a lot better than having to trump my way off the towers and buy these $15 CDs. And so it's not perfect, but it's one way in which the system that otherwise would remain stagnant can evolve.
So you don't think there would have been an iTunes without a Napster?
I don't think so. I know that Steve Jobs copied Kazaa, studied Kazaa, which was the major pirate site of its time, in designing iTunes. I think that Napster begot Kazaa, and Kazaa begot iTunes, and that was, while a little rough along the way, a healthy evolution.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much.
Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu are the authors of Who Controls the Internet. Coming up, Jeff Goldblum in a local production of The Music Man. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Goldblum, starring in a production of The Music Man in Pittsburgh? What do you think? It's the premise of his new movie, Pittsburgh, which, as far as I can tell, is a mockumentary that's part documentary. The premise is that Goldblum, the star of such films as Independence Day, Jurassic Park, The Fly, The Big Chill, and Between the Lines, decides to star in a musical in his hometown. He wants to do this so that he can perform opposite his new girlfriend, Catherine Reiford. She's a Canadian who's about 30 years younger than he is and is trying to get her green card. Goldblum is also joined in the cast of The Music Man by his friends Ed Begley Jr. and Ileana Douglas. In the opening scene of the film Pittsburgh, Goldblum is talking to Begley and his wife, telling them about his new girlfriend.
Where'd you meet her?
She was starring in 42nd Street, the tour.
We saw 42nd
Street.
And what part did she play?
She's the young, thin young girl, Peggy Sawyer.
Catherine Reiford.
Yeah, Catherine Reiford.
She's like 19?
No, she's
not 19.
She's 23.
Wow.
Oh, that's a big difference.
Here we go. Here we go.
Now, you may think that a big star like Goldblum would intimidate everyone in a local production of The Music Man, but the director of this production has no trouble criticizing Goldblum's performance.
Jeffrey?
Yes, sir.
Where you're going with Harold Hill right now is totally in the wrong direction. He seems smarmy. He seems agitated. Your constant movement is distracting to the point where, and I'm crazy about you, and at one point I thought, I'm just going to shoot him. They're going to hate you.
That's a scene from Pittsburgh. Jeff Goldblum, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start here by confessing that I don't have a clue which parts of this movie are real documentary and which parts are more like mockumentary.
Yeah, that's great. Really? That's so interesting. Different people see it in different ways, you know, and, you know, would it be more delightful to you if you didn't know, first of all, if you didn't know before you'd seen it, or if now you found out, are you interested, or would you rather not know? Is it like a magic trick? Or the people listening, you know, having not seen it maybe, should we keep them in the dark about certain things? What do you think?
No, I think we should let me know.
Okay. All right. Do you have an idea about, or are you curious about
certain
things?
Well, I'm kind of curious, like, did you really do this show because it was a way to get your girlfriend a green card?
What do you think? What do you think, any element of that is real? Then I'll tell you.
I don't know. I'm being neutral here. I don't know.
Really?
Yeah.
That's nice. I hope, you know, it's my hope that it sort of plays like, and we always wanted to do something that finally at least played like a narrative fictional movie and had that kind of enjoyment in it. You know, we used different techniques to make it real, naturalistic, spontaneous, complicated, like real life. But for instance, yes, that element is true. Played by Catherine Reiford, was at that point my girlfriend, my fiance. She did have those exactly literal difficulties and challenges with her green card, and the Pittsburgh situation, the show which happened and that we auditioned for and got helped with that. That was all true, in fact.
So was the Music Man already slated to be produced in Pittsburgh by this regional theater company, or did you suggest that for the movie?
No, it was actually, as Catherine Reiford says in the movie, she found out about it the way she found out. It was slated already, and her agent found out about it, and like that. What you don't know is that we were, in from the movie, is that I, for 6 years, was looking for, had this germ of an idea. It sort of evolved from one thing to another. And as we closed in on, you know, a couple of years ago, I was thinking about a movie that took place in Pittsburgh where this Jeff Goldblum character, much like a Larry David or a Being John Malkovich or a parallel universe version of Jeff Goldblum in real life, could go back to Pittsburgh and encounter his family in some way, and his hometown. And so we were trying to cook up some reason why I might do that was fictional, or that maybe we could have as a real event, and da-da-da-da. And then this came about.
Now, the director in the film, not the director of the documentary, but the director of The Music Man, is actually
Richard
kind of
Sibelico.
Yeah, he's kind of hard on you in a couple of scenes. He, at one point, he tells you 100% potential, but you're only at 25. So, was he really critical of your performance when you were rehearsing? And what was it like, real documentary, not mockumentary? What was it like to have a regional theater director criticizing your performance in front of a camera shooting this for a documentary?
See, I think it's all performance in a way, just like what I was doing was I thought, very much a kind of performance. When we told people like Richard Sibelico, a wonderful, interesting guy who I think gives a wonderful performance, I think, in the movie, when we told him, really just ignore our home, you know, movie camera, we're kind of making a home movie of this, and we're kind of documenting this for who knows what. But just go about your job and just try to, you know, direct me and do whatever you do. That's what he did. But I think whenever you tell somebody that, especially somebody theatrical, and I think somebody like Richard, maybe it alters what they do. And so really what you get is a performance of some kind, I think. Remember that episode of Dick Van Dyke when they bring tape recorders into the writing room?
Oh, God, no, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, well, they bring, you know, they're writers on this comedy show, and they bring a tape recorder into the writing room, and all of a sudden everybody changes. You know, they start, even though it's not being visually recorded, they start wearing different things, and they become different characters. Well, you know, so it's a kind of performance. Anyway, I think he might have been doing something like that, and he knew that we were also in this movie doing something kind of, you know, fresh and also improvising and making stuff up. But I think when he was critical of me, no, he was just doing his job.
You've taught acting for many years, right?
I have for the last 15, 20 years at a place called Playhouse West whenever I'm not working in North Hollywood.
Do you teach the way you were taught, or do you teach something really different than the way you were taught?
That's a good question. I was taught by a masterful acting teacher named Sanford Meisner. You probably know about him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I teach something like the way I was taught. Yeah, and we teach his. He had a brilliant kind of foundational training program for the early actor that I pretty much follow along. That's right. His the first element of which is this improvisation, very particular kind of improvisation that I teach. Although as I've taught, and you know, one of the reasons I taught was to sort of take the course again from the inside out and really know as much as I could about it, just to make sure I didn't miss anything. And as I've taught, I've gotten more excited and passionate and clear and particular about what I think he had in mind and what I like to have in mind with my own, the use of it for myself and as I teach it to students.
Who are the directors who you learn the most from working with?
Well, you know, I've been lucky. I've worked with a lot of great directors. I worked with Robert Altman early on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a great teacher, I think. And I think the things that I've done that I've sort of had something to do with initiating, I did this little short movie that I directed. You know, I think I used as inspiration, you know, something of what I think he was doing in Nashville and in this Pittsburgh movie. You know, I'm still inspired by his improvisation, use of real life, use of real people, non-actors and actors, all that, you know.
What are some of the things that happened in Nashville that you were able to think about or borrow from in Pittsburgh?
Well, for instance, you know, I think one of the things that Robert Altman does is always get people to collaborate, create an atmosphere of real trustfulness. You know, one trusts him so much, and you know you're in good hands, and the movie's going to be interesting. And he makes the, you know, all the participants responsible for what they're doing. And so, as a result, it makes you come up with your best stuff. How can I describe that? For instance, he would go, you know, and it's not that he's complacent or not visionary, very much the opposite. He's very specific and about his world and what he wants to paint, you know, but he will say to the actors something like, well, what am I going to photograph today? You figure out what I'm going to photograph and I'll photograph it. In other words, he sort of causes the actor to come up with their best stuff. And he uses what exists, another kind of Sandy Meisnerism, but he uses accident, you know, movie making has a lot to do with what's accidental and what exists at the moment. And something about the magic of the moment. And he makes a kind of particularly masterful use of that. He told me before Nashville to learn a bunch of magic tricks. It wasn't in the script, but he said, you know, I have an idea. Get a hold of in New York there where you're living now. Get a hold of a sleight of hand guy and learn a whole bunch of tricks and bring him down here. Maybe we can fit him in the movie. So I did, and I'd bring him on the set, and he'd sort of make up on the spot how they could be incorporated, and a couple of them are still in, you know, like that. Yeah.
Now, one of your really early roles was one of the men in Death Wish who kills Charles Bronson's wife and rapes his daughter.
Yes.
And I've been thinking, like, what's it like to get started in a scene like that?
Mm. It was great for me. I had just come out of Sandy Meisner School, and miraculously, it was the first thing I auditioned for. I didn't, you know, so it was great. I went and kind of, you know, improvised this sort of little violent scene for the director, Michael Winner, and did it. And Michael Winner, who's now passed on, was notorious for yelling and kind of doing that. And I remember the first time I was kind of coming up the stairs, sneaking up the stairs in order to kind of pounce on these couple of women. It was a camera rehearsal. I was unfamiliar with all any of this. And I was sort of, you know, skulking up, and they were setting the camera. And he yells at the top of his lungs, this is the first thing I ever did, "Goldblum, start acting now." he was British, and he really, you know, scared me. And he really, and that's about all the direction I ever got from him. But you know, in a way, it wasn't bad direction. It was like Richard Sibelico. It wasn't. It had its harshness to it, but there was something probably legitimate in it too. Just start doing it was the idea.
My guest is Jeff Goldblum. His new movie is called Pittsburgh. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeff Goldblum. His new film, Pittsburgh, is about how and why he decided to star in a Pittsburgh production of The Music Man. The movie combines mockumentary and documentary. Now the premise in Pittsburgh is that you've just fallen in love with a young woman in her 20s who starred in the road production of 42nd Street. And she's from Canada. She needs a green card. One way to get it is for you to get married. Another way to get it is to do this musical together. And I think you're engaged when the movie's being made, and you do this musical together. And reading between the lines, it sounds like you're not together anymore.
That's true. We actually were together, and at this point, we're not together. That's right. We broke up several months ago.
Is it strange to have this film about this new and real relationship between you, so real that you're thinking of getting married, and now the movie comes out, and everybody who sees it will get caught up in this new relationship, except that's all behind you now. It's over.
That's true. But like I say, I always, you know, I think, I hope people will, you know, wonder whether we were ever together or any of that was true. I hope it plays. Now, I think it plays, it's crowd-pleasing like a, you know, narrative movie. And like a fictional movie, and I'm hoping they'll see people's acting in it and go, hey, that's just really good, interesting, spontaneous acting. I wonder if it's scripted, and they're just doing that in a way that's kind of pretty good. And the relationships, you know, and Cassavetes would use, you know, people's real mother as their mother, you know, and, you know, the relationships seem very rich and kind of real. So that's what I'm hoping. Now, about... it's okay. Sure, it's strange. It's always strange seeing yourself in this. It's kind of strange and mostly exciting. I've never been as psycho-emotionally kind of invested in a movie. I kind of, you know, have been thinking about this for a while and was central in kind of getting the whole thing done. And so I'm excited about it. But I know what you mean. There's, you know, yeah, well, things come and go. But the movie also is about... I think, you know, essentially, has this character, Jeff Goldblum, lost his mind? Has he gone crazy? Is this relationship is it ill-advised, like people in the movie are telling me? Is it
Is it
impetuous? Does he have some romantic kind of crazy idea because of one thing or another, his own quirks, are they totally incompatible, or is there something here? And what the heck is he doing? You know, racing after this, you know, headlong this Pittsburgh idea and going back to Pittsburgh. Has he lost his mind? And is his manager right? You know, is he, you know, shooting himself in the foot professionally? And is all this ill advised? Well, that's what we ask in the movie. And in a way, the answer is. Yes. Is yes, that character in that movie is a bit nutty. And, you know, it's amusing to me to, you know, consider my own nuttiness is the answer.
There's a scene in the movie where you and Moby and Ileana Douglas are singing Gary Indiana together while he plays guitar behind you. How did that come about?
I love that scene. That was, well, once again, you know, our technique. He was acting. In fact, I hate to give things away, but they weren't a couple. they weren't really boyfriend and girlfriend, and they were acting. And he said, well, what do you want me to do before we do this? And I said, well, just, you know, nobody will ever know, because that's what we're all doing. Use as much of your real life as you can. You can reference things in your real life or expose anything in your real life. Just reveal anything you want to reveal. Well, so I don't know what he revealed that was real at all. I'll never know that. But we just got the cameras rolling and got me as I entered his apartment, I think, for the first time. So me in that scene, when I'm seeing his gold and platinum records, I'm seeing them for the first time, and we start talking, and we talk about this and that, and we hadn't planned to do that. I had that little, you know, music book from the Music Man, and it just happened as it happened on camera. I said, you know, do you have your guitar, and can we sing something, and what do you want to sing? And we chose it on camera and then set out to sing it. I like that. I like our rendition of that.
Yeah, I like that scene a lot.
Thanks.
Well, Jeff Goldblum, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck with the movie.
Oh, thank you so much.
Jeff Goldblum's new movie is called Pittsburgh. It premieres this weekend at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York. I'm Terry Gross.
Every now and then I look up and I can't believe that I'm sitting in my living room playing music with Jeff Goldblum.
Thank you.
Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana. Let me say it once again. If you'd like to have a logical explanation, how I happened on this elegant situation, I will say without a moment of hesitation, there is just one place that can light my face.
Gary, Indiana, Gary,
Indiana, not Louisiana, Paris, France, New York, or Rome.
But Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, my home sweet home.
That's a nice song.
You like that?
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From the Roth Family Foundation for the NPR Endowment, helping to fund NPR's West Coast Production Center. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Robert Smigel, the creator of TV Funhouse and Triumph the Insult comic Dog. This weekend, Saturday Night Live will be devoted to his animated shorts. And we remember jazz photographer William Gottlieb, who died this week. We'll hear the story behind his famous photo of Billie Holiday. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.